Pushkin.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey, Last Archive listeners. Welcome to our new 6-episode series called The Deadline. Last year, Jill Lepore, the acclaimed New Yorker writer, American historian, and founding host of this show, published a book called The Deadline. It's a compilation of years' worth of beautiful essays Jill's written. We've chosen 6 to bring you in this series, and each week for the next 6 weeks, Jill's going to read one of her essays, and then stick around after to talk about its craft and themes. To start, we have one of my personal favorite essays by Jill, The Iceman, about the history of cryogenic freezing and the perils of being unable to let go of the past. And in our conversation, Jill and I talked a bit about where this very strange essay began and the moral challenges of writing about a living person.
This is a crazy origin story. I don't think I've ever told this before, but I had been writing for The New Yorker for a bunch of years and just doing book reviews, not just. I mean, I love that work. But my editor said, do you want to profile somebody? And I was like a living person?
Okay, here's the essay. Stick around after for our conversation.
The Iceman. Robert C.W. Ettinger, who thinks death is for chumps, drives a rusty white Chevy Lumina with a bumper sticker on the rear that reads, Choose Life. Ettinger is 91 years old, bent and crooked. His face is splotched, his goatee grizzled, his gray hair wispy and unkempt. He leans on a worn wooden cane and wears a thick orthopedic shoe on his left foot. His legs were smashed when he was hit by German mortar fire in November 1944, just before the Battle of the Bulge. He spent 4 years in an army hospital where he had bone grafts and skin grafts. Antibiotics saved his life. More recently, he has undergone angioplasty, cataract surgery, a hemorrhoidectomy, and prostate surgery, twice. That Ettinger endures is a miracle of science. Actuarially, chances are good that he'll be dying soon, and if the going gets much tougher, he'll kill himself. He's planned that down to the last detail. He has one concern. The problem, of course, with suicide is that if you don't do it right, you face autopsy, he told me. And then you're no good for freezing. Ettinger is a founder of the cryonics movement. When he dies, the blood will be drained from his body, antifreeze will be pumped into his arteries, and holes will be drilled into his skull, after which he'll be stored in a vat of liquid nitrogen at minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit. He expects to be defrosted sometime between 50 and 200 years from now by scientists who will make him young and strong and tireless. Ettinger has already frozen his mother and his 2 wives, along with 92 other people who await resurrection inside giant freezers in a building 5 minutes away from his house in Clinton Township, Michigan. I went out to Michigan to meet Ettinger one May. Clinton Township, population 95,648 at the last census, 95,743 if you count the corpses at the Cryonics Institute. Our patients are not truly dead in any fundamental sense, Ettinger says. lies 20 miles northeast of Detroit. The township is named for New York's Erie Canal building governor, DeWitt Clinton. Easterners began arriving in droves soon after the canal was completed in 1825. Ground was broken for a canal to Kalamazoo in 1838, a year after Michigan joined the Union. But then the railroad came. At the Clinton Township Historic Village, which consists of a log cabin, an old meeting house, and a wishing well, the grass was squishy, as if someone had left the sprinklers on too long. Actually, it was the old abandoned Clinton-Kalamazoo Canal, oozing up. The past has a way of doing that. There are only three ways to go when you die. You can be buried, burned, or frozen. If there is no God, Edinger says, your only chance at an afterlife is option three. I decided to take a closer look at options one and two. Driving along Cass Avenue, I passed the First Presbyterian Church, where a sign out front read, "Life is short, so pray hard." Down the road, I stopped at Clinton Grove Memorial Park, which was established in 1855 and is the oldest burial ground around. A canopy of oaks and elms shelters 6,000 19th century dead. Vacancies remain. A flashing sign cycled through three messages. Cremation space, $395. Monuments, sold here. Think spring. Across the street are two tombstone firms, Lincoln Granite, family-owned and operated since 1903, and Clinton Grove Granite Works, established 1929. Both offices were closed, so I browsed through the outdoor displays, gravestones of pink and gray granite, their borders engraved with stock sentiments. "Forever in our hearts, inside two valentines, in God's care," on a banner beneath a cross. In the middle of each stone, a polished empty space awaits only a pair of dates and someone's name. I tried to think spring. The Cryonics Institute occupies a 7,000-square-foot brick-fronted warehouse in an industrial park behind the township's water and sewage building. Past a shabby waiting room is the small office of Andy Zawacki. Andy constitutes half of CI's full-time staff. He is also one of CI's more than 800 members, which means that he plans to be frozen when he dies. Lifetime members pay $1,250 to join and $28,000 upon death. They are encouraged to pay by making the Institute the beneficiary of their life insurance policies. On CI's website, Andy wears a lab coat as if he were a scientist or a doctor, but mostly he's a handyman. He's been working for CI since he graduated from high school. He's lumpy and balding and soft-spoken, but other than that, not a bit like Peter Lorre. He answered the door and took me into the office, where Robert Edinger was waiting. I started to say hello. "You want to see it?" Edinger asked. Andy led us down the hall and through a door into a storage area with fluorescent lights and 16-foot-high ceilings. Almost everything in the room was white or silver, like the inside of a refrigerator just off the truck from Sears. It sounded like a refrigerator, too, a faintly throbbing, There were 14 cylindrical freezers. They looked like propane tanks, the kind you attach to your gas grill, except that they were about 10 feet tall and 6 feet wide. Each held 6 patients. All but 4 were filled. There were also 3 older rectangular freezers, and then there was a stainless steel thermos about the size of a rain barrel, and that's where Edinger was headed. He lifted the lid. Liquid nitrogen wafted out. "Cats," he said. He blew into the container and waved his hand, trying to clear the vapor. "Can't see much, I guess." I peered in. I blew. We blew together. I couldn't see a thing. "Cats in there?" I asked, peering, blowing. "Yep." "How many?" "Don't know," Andy interjected. "We've got about 60 pets, mostly dogs and cats." "A few birds," Edinger added. He closed the lid. I stared at the giant freezers. "Are they upside down?" Better for the brain on thawing, I guess. I pictured hibernating bats. "Well, not the first ones," Edinger explained. "We put them in horizontally. Everyone else in the cylinders is upside down."
"And in canisters or something within the cylinders?"
"Nope," he shook his head. "Sleeping bags."
"Just regular sleeping bags like from Kmart?"
"No," Andy said. "Walmart." Edinger, leaning on his cane, surveyed the room. Your mother and your two wives," I began hesitantly. "Are they all in this room?"
"Yep."
"And where?" No idea, he shrugged. My mother and my first wife used to be over there, he said, pointing to one corner of the room. But we moved them over there, he pointed to the cylinders. Andy, do you know where they are? That one, Andy indicated one of the cylinders with his chin. Or maybe that one? One of those two. I can check. Edinger, slightly sheepish. We have a chart. Robert Edinger was born in Atlantic City in December of 1918. His mother's family came from Odessa. His father was born in Germany. In about 1922, the Edingers moved to Detroit. Edinger's father ran a furniture store, and the family lived in a house on Calvert Street, where in 1927, when he was 8 years old, Edinger started reading Amazing Stories, the first magazine of what its editor, Hugo Gernsback, called Scientifiction. Extravagant fiction today, cold fact tomorrow. Much in Gernsback's stories has come true. Rockets, television, computers, cell phones. Gernsback's stories also revisited a literary perennial, immortality. Stories about immortality are ancient. They're part of every religion. They riddle myths and legends. And they always contain an argument with history, because to live forever is to conquer time as much as it is to conquer death. About a century and a half ago, stories about immortality got mixed up with stories about scientists. In 1845, Edgar Allan Poe wrote The Facts in the Case of M. Valdemar, about a mesmerist who hypnotizes a dying man at the instant of his death and keeps him in a trance for 7 months. When he tries to lift the trance, the poor man cries, "For God's sake, quick, quick, put me to sleep, or quick, waken me, quick, I say to you that I am dead," and promptly melts into a pool of putrescence. In A Thousand Deaths, an early Jack London short story from 1899, the narrator's mad scientist father repeatedly kills and revives him, leaving him dead for longer and longer stretches. Another time, after being suffocated, he kept me in cold storage for 3 months, not permitting me to freeze or decay. Rot is always a problem for the living dead, which is why resurrectionists borrow a good deal from methods used in preserving food. In 1766, the Scottish surgeon John Hunter tried to animate frozen fish. Benjamin Franklin thought that if he could be preserved in a vat of Madeira wine, he would have liked very much to see what the world was like in a century or two. People used to eat their food fresh, canned, or salted until someone got the idea to sell pond ice, and then those who could afford it paid to have ice delivered by the iceman. Starting in the 1890s, housewives could rent lockers in cold storage warehouses. All this made for some fantastic science fiction. In January 1930, Gernsback published The Corpse That Lived. A man who dies in a plane crash in the year 2025 is immersed in a bathtub of ice cubes and brought back to life by an electric pulse. The next month's issue included The Iceman. Marcus Publius, frozen in Rome in 59 BCE, is defrosted in 1928 by a professor who's remarkably handy with an electric blanket. Edinger dates his interest in immortality to 1931, when, at the age of 12, he read The Jameson Satellite, in which a dying professor has himself entombed in a rocket and launched into the cold storage of space. 40 million years pass, whereupon a race of mechanical men transplant Jameson's brain into a body like theirs, steel head, probing tentacles, so that he, too, can be an everlasting Zorome. I grew up with the expectation that one day we would learn how to reverse aging, Edinger has said. Immortality is no good if you're doomed to decrepitude. When Edinger was shot in the Second World War, he thought naturally about death. In the hospital, he wrote the kind of fiction that he had read as a boy. The Penultimate Trump was published in 1948 in a Gernsback knockoff called Startling Stories and tells of H.T. Haworth, who is 92 years old and survives only because his doctors have managed to cobble him together. They give him gland extracts. They give him vitamins. They give him blood transfusions. They give him false teeth, eyeglasses, arch supports. They cut out his varicose veins, his appendix, one of his kidneys. Haworth, pursuing immortality with the same ruthlessness with which he had pursued an ill-gotten fortune, pays a brilliant young scientist to put him to sleep in a nice refrigerator until people really know something about the body. The scientist says, "We'd better put him in a vault in Michigan, very safe country, geologically." Michigan is also where freezers come from. In 1923, the year after the Ettingers moved to Detroit, a company called Frigidaire, owned by General Motors and based in Detroit, began selling refrigerators and cabinets for home use. A chemist hired by General Motors developed Freon 12. In the 1930s, General Foods launched Bird's Eye Frozen Foods. By 1944, more than 85% of American homes had refrigerators. When the war ended, Americans had babies and built suburbs and bought appliances. 200,000 freezers were manufactured in 1946, and twice as many the following year. H.D. Haworth makes his arrangements in secret, convinced that if anyone found out what he was doing, everyone would demand a Frigidaire instead of a coffin. He dies. The scientist puts him in a freezer. 3 centuries later, he awakens, naked, in a room with a beautiful woman doctor, and observes that he is young, strong, and to his astonished delight, ready. A long-forgotten stimulus performed its ancient function. Unfortunately, things don't turn out as well as he had hoped. Word had got out, and everybody had started going into the freezatoria. In the absence of any expectation of heaven, people had begun behaving very badly. Scientists had therefore invented the Farbenstein probe to find out if a sleeper had ever sinned. After scanning Haworth's brain, the probe sentences him to a penal colony on a planet that used to be called Mars. "What do they call it now?" he asks. "Now they call it hell." Inside the Cryonics Institute, I stood with Ettinger contemplating Haworth and finding it hard not to think about the Cerebral Library, which appeared in Amazing Stories 2 months before the Jameson satellite, and which involves a mad scientist who hires a Chinese surgeon to help him collect 500 brains in glass jars. This place reminded me of a library, too, or more of an archive, a place where people deposit their papers, the contents of their heads, when they're dead, so that someone, some future historian, can find them and bring them back to life. "Have you got any neuros?" I asked. "A neuro is a severed head. The theory is that scientists in the future, like the Zoromes, will give you a new body, so why bother saving the old one if your brain is all they'll need? In 2002, when Red Sox baseball great Ted Williams died, his head was sawed off and frozen. It is now stored at the Alcor Life Extension Foundation in Scottsdale, Arizona. Alcor, with some 900 members and 89 patients, is CI's chief rival, although it charges a great deal more for eternal life. After Williams died, his oldest daughter insisted that her father had not wanted to be frozen and produced a will in which he stated that he wished to be cremated, whereupon his son found, in the trunk of Williams's car, a piece of scrap paper that said something about biostasis. Ettinger has appeared on ABC World News Tonight and has been interviewed by the New York Times, where he was referred to as Dr. Ettinger. Elsewhere, reporters have called him a Michigan physics professor. Ettinger has 2 master's degrees, one in physics and the other in mathematics, both from Wayne State University, which he attended on the GI Bill after the war. Many decades ago, he taught at Highland Park Community College, a school that no longer exists. He doesn't call himself doctor or professor, but he does consider himself a scientist, insofar as he has a scientific attitude. Neuropreservation has a scientific attitude, too, but that doesn't make it a science. It's more like extremely optimistic cosmetic surgery. It promises to cure hair loss, wrinkles, senescence, impotence, and death all at once. Ah, yes, but will it work? It'd be going too far to say that stranger things have happened, because they haven't. Reanimating and rejuvenating the dead would be several orders of magnitude stranger than, say, landing on the moon. But it does boast a handful of somewhat prominent promoters and a much larger group of defenders, whose position amounts to, what the hell, it's worth a try. Ralph Merkel, a former professor of computer science at Georgia Tech, who now teaches at a place called Singularity University, serves on Alcor's board of directors. Merkel happens to be the grandnephew of Fred Merkel, whose base running error, he failed to touch second, cost the New York Giants the National League pennant in 1908, an error known forever after as Merkel's boner. The MIT professor Marvin Minsky, who will await resurrection at Alcor, emailed me, in lieu of an explanation, this helpful chart. If cryonics works and you sign up, you live. If it doesn't work, you die and lose your life insurance. But if you do nothing, either way, you die. Which looks a lot like this way of thinking. If God exists and you pray hard, you live. And if God doesn't exist, you die. But if you do nothing, you die either way. And which, while altogether different from faith, is another way of trying to cover all the bases. As for its scientific plausibility, credentialed laboratory scientists who conduct peer-reviewed experiments having to do with the storage of organic tissue at very low temperatures, embryos, for instance, or organs for transplant, do not generally think the dead will one day awaken. The consensus appears to be that when you try to defrost a frozen corpse, you get mush. And even if in the future scientists could repair the damage done to cells by freezing and thawing, what they would have at best is a cadaver. Merkel believes that nanotechnology will solve this problem. Microscopic robots will repair the cells one by one. But as Edinger himself points out, anyone wanting to resurrect and rejuvenate the dead must complete 4 tasks. Cure the person of what killed her. Reverse the decay that set in between death and freezing. Repair the damage done by the freezing itself, and make her young again. Even Orpheus would be daunted. And of course, success would also seem to depend on whether the people doing the freezing are doing it well. On August 18, 2003, Sports Illustrated published an investigative report by Tom Verducci. Using tapes, photographs, and documents provided by Larry Johnson, Alcor's chief operating officer at the time, Verducci described how Williams's head had been shaved, drilled with holes, accidentally cracked as many as 10 times, and moved among 3 receptacles until it was finally put in a liquid nitrogen-filled steel can that resembles a lobster pot. Alcor denies that the head was mishandled. "No," Edinger declared, "we don't do neuros." "But," Andy began. "Oh, right." In 1999, a cryonics firm called CryoCare went under. "We do have heads," Edinger said. "Transfers." Robert Edinger announced the dawn of what he called the freezer era at the height of the Cold War. In 1949, he met his first wife, Elaine, at a Zionist meeting. In the 1950s, they moved to the suburbs and had 2 children. In the basement of their house in Oak Park, Michigan, Edinger built a fallout shelter and waited for a scientist to read Penultimate Trump and turn today's extravagant fiction into tomorrow's cold fact. Finally, he decided to do it himself. In 1962, he wrote a 60-page manifesto and sent a copy to Frederick Pohl, the editor of the science fiction magazine Worlds of Tomorrow. Pohl, who was a regular guest on an all-night New York AM radio broadcast, The Long John Nebel Show, arranged for Edinger to be invited. One thing led to another, and eventually Thomas McCormick, a junior editor at Doubleday, agreed to publish Edinger's manifesto. The prospect of immortality appeared in 1964, the year Dr. Strangelove hit theaters. Through that lens, mortality begins to look rather a lot like mutual assured destruction, and immortality, at 320 degrees below, like nothing so much as a fabulously air-conditioned fallout shelter. In Strangelove, the world faces nuclear Armageddon. On orders from the U.S. Air Force general who was convinced of a communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids, American airmen have dropped a bomb on Russia, thereby triggering the Soviets' doomsday machine. Everyone on the planet is about to die. From the war room in Washington, the U.S. president, played by Peter Sellers, entertains proposals made by his scientific advisor, Dr. Strangelove, also Sellers. Strangelove: "Mr. President, I would not rule out the chance to preserve a nucleus of human specimens. It would be quite easy at the bottom of some of our deeper mine shafts." President: "How long would you have to stay down there?" Strangelove pulls out a circular slide rule. "Well, let's see now. I think possibly 100 years. After the Manhattan Project, after Sputnik, after dishwashers and electric mixers, either scientists and engineers were on the verge of solving everything, in which case go into the freezer because the world will be even better when you wake up, or someone was about to launch an atomic bomb, in which case go into the freezer because maybe you'll survive. Before long," Edinger predicted, "the objectors will include only a handful of eccentrics." Edinger conceded that the logistics of freezing the dead might prove difficult at first, especially in what he called the retarded nations, where makeshifts may be necessary to stretch the rupees, pesos, etc. In poor, hot countries, bodies will be stored in vaults insulated with straw and cooled with dry ice, where in all likelihood they will simply rot. No worries. It will not at first greatly matter how skillfully the bodies are preserved, so long as hope is preserved. But if no one ever dies, won't there be too many people on the planet? The people could simply agree to share the available space in shifts, Edinger suggested, going into suspended animation from time to time to make room for others. There will be no childbirth. Fetuses will be incubated in jars. Essentially, motherhood will be abolished. Then, too, eugenics will help keep the birth rate down, and deformed babies could be frozen against the day that someone might actually want them or figure out how to fix them. Cretins, for instance, or babies born with cerebral palsy. Would not early freezing be a true mercy? For the weak-minded who might find making such a decision difficult, Edinger offered a philosophical rule of thumb. Ask yourself, if the child were already frozen, and it were within my power to return him to deformed life, would I do so? If the answer is negative, then probably the freezer is where he belongs. On the floor in front of the freezers at the Cryonics Institute are four slotted boxes painted white, with a black number in each slot, like the slots in a company mailroom. What's this? Edinger looked away. Andy explained that the numbers refer to the patients, most of whom choose to remain anonymous, and the box is for their families. Over the years, a half dozen have sent flowers, mostly roses, long dead. Attached to one bouquet was a card in an unopened envelope. Turns out that staring at an unopened envelope inside a freezatorium is substantially more depressing than looking at the blank space on a tombstone. Thoughts of spring eluded me. Do patients' families ever visit? I asked. Not many, Andy said. Edinger had wandered off toward the office, passing a half-open door that I hadn't noticed before. What's in there? A storeroom, Edinger called over his shoulder. Used to be a library. We sat down in the conference room. Along the wall hung 28 8x10-inch photographs of patients, beginning with Edinger's mother. His father, who died in 1984 at the age of 89, was not among them. He's in a mausoleum, Edinger said, shaking his head. I tried very hard to get him to be frozen, but his second wife was against it. He was too wimpy to stand up to her. Edinger's brother, who died 10 years ago, proved to be as weak as his father. In his last illness, he became depressed and told his children that he didn't want to be frozen. I told them they should freeze him anyway, but I couldn't get them to, and he was lost. This was how Edinger spoke of the unfrozen dead. His uncle Herman died in a car accident. That was a shame. He was lost. When Prospect of Immortality was published, Edinger became something of a star. He claims plausibly that nearly everyone now active in Cryonics first heard about it, directly or indirectly, from him. Ben Best, CI's current president, picked up a copy at a health food store. Stanley Kubrick read it, Edinger says, and then arranged to meet with him. But when Kubrick died in 1999, he was lost. He is buried in Hertfordshire. Edinger said that he was interviewed by David Frost, Steve Allen, Merv Griffin, and Johnny Carson. Did these people take you seriously? I asked. Talk show hosts don't take anything seriously. They're idiots. He told me he was once on a show with William F. Buckley Jr. What did Buckley make of you? He was aghast at everything I said. This was the first time I'd seen Edinger smile. He thought it was immoral, unethical, unsanitary, against the will of God. He laughed. Buckley understood nothing. The first human being was frozen in 1966. It went badly, and a few months later, the body had to be buried. The following year, Edinger held a press conference when a man named James Bedford was frozen by an organization that later became the Cryonic Society of California. What with one snafu and another, most of the people who were frozen in California rotted. Alcor was founded in 1972. The same year, St. Martin's Press, where Thomas McCormick had moved, published Edinger's second book, Man into Superman, The Startling Potential of Human Evolution and How to Be a Part of It. It begins, by working hard and saving my money, I intend to become an immortal Superman. The following year, Sleeper came out. Miles Monroe, Woody Allen, who runs a health food restaurant in Greenwich Village, goes into the hospital for an ulcer, but when the surgery goes awry, he is covered in bird's eye wrapper and stuck in a freezer for 200 years. When he wakes up, he's peevish, especially after his doctor tells him that his resurrection is a miracle of science. Miles, pacing. To me, a miracle of science is like going to the hospital for a minor operation. I come out the next day and my rent isn't 2,000 months overdue. That's a miracle of science. This is what I call a cosmic screwing. And then, where am I anyhow? I mean, what happened, everybody? Where are all my friends? Doctor, you must understand that everyone you knew in the past has been dead nearly 200 years. Miles, but they all ate organic rice! In Man into Superman, Edinger throws around a lot of Nietzsche and George Bernard Shaw, but shows more evidence of having whiled away the hours reading Penthouse, which began publication in 1965. The world of tomorrow will be unimaginably better than the world of today. How? There will be transsex and supersex. Scientists will invent a sexual superwoman with cleverly designed orifices of various kinds, something like a Wrigley Swiss cheese, but shapelier and more fragrant. Animals will be bred as sex slaves. Even incest might be allowed. Also, scientists will likely equip men with wings, built-in biological weapons, body armor made of hair, and telescoping, fully adjustable sexual organs. Hold on, that last one. Doesn't the existing model already come with that? Edinger saw Allen's film when it came out. He has a lot of good things to say about death, but as far as I know, he's never done anything about it, he said. Like what? Like sign up! For a very long time, no one signed up. Edinger's first patient was his mother, Rhea. He froze her in 1977. Did she want to be frozen? I don't know if she was really enthusiastic about it, but she was willing. His second patient was his first wife, who died in November 1987. What did she think about the prospect of being frozen? She never talked much about it. It was just taken for granted. He remarried the following year. 1 month after Edinger froze his wife, Saul Kent froze the head of his mother, Dora, at the Alcor facility. Kent, the author of Future Sex, 1974, and The Life Extension Revolution, 1980, had become a convert to cryonics after reading Prospect of Immortality on the Beach. He had also founded the vitamin-peddling Life Extension Foundation in Hollywood, Florida, which was raided by the Food and Drug Administration in 1987. The FDA later dropped all charges. For a time, there was some question whether Dora Kent was actually dead when her head was cut off. Edinger's second wife, May, suffered a stroke in Scottsdale, Arizona, in 2000. Edinger was with her. It was horrible. She was helpless. He was helpless. All she was able to do was move one arm, he said, his voice quavering. May knew that she would be frozen. Edinger had paid a local funeral home, a retainer, to practice once a year. She died the day after the stroke. Edinger takes comfort in what happened next. He acted fast. I pronounced death. Anyone can do that in Arizona. And the funeral people were there in a few minutes. We had already started packing her in ice, and the funeral people started right away. She was flown to Detroit. She is patient number 34. She was not lost. Edinger finds nothing so uninteresting as history. When the future expands, he wrote, the past shrinks. In the Golden Age, no one will read Shakespeare. Not only will his work be far too weak in intellect and written in too vague and puny a language, but the problems which concerned him will be, in the main, no more than historical curiosities. Still, Edinger told me when I asked, that his mother and both his wives kept photo albums and that they're at the Institute and that storeroom that was once a library, somewhere. He promised we'd look for them on the second day of my visit, even though he was baffled by my interest. The future, so gleamy and white, how could anyone possibly care about the musty, dusty past? The storeroom was a mess. There was an old Stairmaster, some folding tables. The bookshelves housed a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica, someone's college textbooks, organic chemistry, and a T-shirt with the periodic table. Along one wall stood a bank of file drawers. What's in there? Any patient who wants to can buy a drawer to put things in, Handy said. Really? But not many of them ask. May Edinger did. She kept a diary and requested that it be stored here marked, not to be read until and unless it is deemed useful for the revival. It won't survive, though. Paper turns to dust. Andy rifled through drawer after drawer. At last he found them, 10 bulky albums with flesh-toned covers, pink, brown, and beige. He and I lugged them back to the table in the conference room. And then Edinger and I sat for a good hour, maybe more, and turned pages. The albums were mostly photographs, but there were old documents in there, too. A military ID, a college transcript, newspaper clippings. Edinger hadn't wanted to drag these albums out, but now that he decided to indulge me, he was determined to be thorough. He didn't skip a single photograph, even prying apart pages that had got stuck. He was bored before we began. I could have looked at that stuff forever. The earliest albums belonged to his mother. Sepia pictures of his babyhood. He offered names. That's Leo. That's Pee Wee Russell. He married my mother's sister, Mary. He remembered people from his early years best. He was very sharp on the names of his cousins. Growing up, and he never missed the name of a dog. He plans to freeze the one he has now, Muggsy. May will like that. His father appeared in a picture or two, then disappeared. There followed photographs of Edinger in uniform, handsome, smiling, promising. And on the next pages, in casts, in wheelchairs, on crutches, a young man cut down. Here was his wedding, under a huppah. The next albums were Elaine's, snapshots of post-war suburbia, the paddle pool, the tricycle, boys with crew cuts, girls in checkered dresses. And then there was a long gap until May's album started. There were a handful of pictures of Edinger, but many more, of sweetly happy May, surrounded by people, her bowling league, her children, and grandchildren from her first marriage. That's one of Pat's kids, he'd say, or more often than not, who the hell is that? I don't know who the hell that is. When you wake up, nearly everyone in these albums will be gone, I said. Won't you miss them? I hope to see the people I knew before, that I loved before, Edinger sighed. Most of the people I grew up with are already gone. That's been true for a long time. Most of the people anybody grows up with, they lose track of. We lose them. Unless we save them. In the freezer. In an archive. In our children. Forever in our hearts. In God's care. We'd gone through one of the albums. 2, 5, 8. I asked why Chronix is, by any objective measure, a failure. Edinger talked about something he calls the legacy effect. The crippling hold of the past. If not for that, the freezer era would have dawned in 1964, when it was supposed to. And then, as abruptly as we began, we were done. He pulled himself up to standing, grabbed his cane, and tapped the last page of the final photo album. Someone should have put labels on these things, he muttered. Just after I left Michigan, Edinger self-published a new book, Universe, toward a self-centered philosophy of immortalism and cryonics. You are the most important person in the universe. No one else matters. And the Cryonics Institute admitted a new patient. Patient number 93 was born Billy Joe Bonshall, but it had his name legally changed to William Constitution O'Rights. He had no known occupation, although he liked to dress up as a priest. Bill O'Rights was 43 when he deanimated in a hospital in Maine. The next day, his body was flown to Detroit in an icebox. At the Fallman and Walsh funeral home, Jim Walsh opened the body and pumped in 8 liters of ethylene glycol. Then he brought it to CI, where Andy put it into a Walmart sleeping bag and placed it in a cooling box. A few days later, patient number 93 was hoisted up on a forklift and lowered into a freezer, headfirst, like a hibernating bat, beside invisible cats, inside a 7,000-square-foot building in an industrial park in the heart of America, where some of the sorriest ideas of a godforsaken and alienated modernity endure. Robert C.W. Edinger might be the Institute's next patient, but for now he's holding on. The longer he lives, the better his chances, because in the Golden Age, or what used to be called hell, scientists choosing which patients to thaw will follow a simple rule. Last in, first out. 2010. Postscript. Robert Edinger died in 2011 at the age of 92. His remains are stored at the Cryonics Institute.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
All right, we're going to talk about the Iceman.
Okay.
For this essay, I want to ask you about the lead and writing a great lead, because this essay has a great lead.
Okay.
And I was wondering, so our listeners have already heard this, but would you be willing to read the opening paragraph?
Yeah, I should because I don't remember it in any way. Oh, yeah, now I remember.
It's just a kick-ass.
Robert C.W. Edinger, who thinks death is for chumps, drives a rusty white Chevy Lumina with a bumper sticker on the rear that reads, "Choose Life." Edinger is 91 years old, bent and crooked. His face is splotched, his goatee grizzled, his gray hair wispy and unkempt. He leans on a worn wooden cane and wears a thick orthopedic shoe on his left foot. His legs were smashed when he was hit by German mortar fire in November 1944, just before the Battle of the Bulge. He spent 4 years in an army hospital, where he had bone grafts and skin grafts. Antibiotics saved his life. More recently, he has undergone angioplasty, cataract surgery, a hemorrhoidectomy, and prostate surgery twice. That Edinger endures is a miracle of science. Actuarially, chances are good that he'll be dying soon. And if the going gets much rougher, he'll kill himself. He's planned that down to the last detail. He has one concern. The problem, of course, with suicide is that if you don't do it right, you face autopsy, he told me. And then you're no good for freezing.
It's just so good. Can you talk about where the idea for this story came from and then when you came up with the idea for the lead?
Okay. Yeah. So this is a crazy origin story. I don't think I've ever told this before. But I had been writing for The New Yorker for a bunch of years and just doing book reviews, not just. I mean, I love that work. But my editor said, "Do you want to profile somebody?" And I was like a living person? and he said, "Yeah, you know, want to try that out, give that a shot." And I was very excited at the idea of it. But I don't have any training as a journalist or really much experience. And I'm a historian. I'm used to writing about the dead. And the dead, you know, don't talk back. Most of the people I had written about at that point were, you know, died in the 18th century or the 17th century. Like, I just, the idea of reckoning with a living person was scary to me. So in one way, I ended up pitching Edinger because he was almost dead. But
he did die like the year after this came out.
He died soon after this came out. But the real reason that I wrote about this, so it was Halloween and my oldest kid was just turning 10. And it was like the part of this year in the history of the Red Sox where the Red Sox were finally winning. It was after they'd won the 2004 World Championship, after they'd won the 2007 World Championship. So we had a lot of Red Sox in our lives. And he wanted to be dead Ted Williams for Halloween because there had been a story about how Ted Williams, one of his kids said that he had wanted to be frozen when he died. And so they had decapitated him and his head was in like a lobster pot in Arizona waiting for be reanimated and reattached to a new body. And it was this crazy story. So we made this hilarious costume. Like we got a basketball and made a paper mache head and painted it. And we had this head and then, you know, wore a Red Sox hat, like with a hanger that propped it up over his head. So he was a headless Ted Williams and carried around the empty head and collected candy. And it was great. It was an awesome costume.
An all-time costume.
It was an all-time costume. But this was right around when then the following spring, so that was when my kid was 9. The following spring, he was going to turn 10, and I really didn't want to keep the head. I actually found the head really upsetting, the paper mache head that was just like sitting in his room. And I'm also a compulsive throw-outer of things. I hate keeping things. So I really wanted to throw it out. He didn't want to throw it. I wanted to put it in the recycling bin and be rid of it. He didn't want to throw it out. And his 10th birthday was the 10th anniversary of the death of my best friend who died while I was giving birth to him. And on the 10th anniversary of her death, I still hadn't dealt with her death because I came home from the hospital with a newborn and I went and delivered a eulogy. And then I just kind of like put the whole story of her life and my grief over the loss of her in a box. Actually in a box. I collected her papers. I printed out all of her email from her computer and I gave it to an archive. So I knew that it was kind of crippling me emotionally that I'd never grieved for this person because I'd never really let her go. And I wasn't with her on her deathbed because I was on a childbirth bed. And I like never forgiven myself for not being with her. So on the 10th anniversary of her death, I went to the library where I had donated the archive of her papers. And I put a fellow at a call slip and they brought them out to me. And they're not open to the public. It was just, you know, they're closed for a while. And I spent a day in the library reading through, you know, my old emails with her, her emails with her friends, her letters, her dissertation drafts or whatever. And I was horrified. It was the most grotesque thing I've ever done. I felt overwhelmed with how wrong it was that I had kept her things without her permission. She never said she wanted her papers to be kept for future researchers or for me. She didn't leave me that. She left me her computer. We never discussed this. And as a historian, whenever I go pull like a box out of the archive and read someone's papers, I am so confident that I know them. Like the person, like a specter, like arises from the box and forms in the room and floats around. And I'm like, hello, my name's Jill. And who are you? And like, I feel like I get to know somebody. Like I'm reading, you know, Edgar Allan Poe's papers or something. Like he's in the room with me. I get him. I know him. That's what the work of a historian is. And reading these papers, my friend was not in that box. The only thing that was in that box was my grief. And it seemed grotesque to me that I had kept them. And then I also was kind of crushed with this kind of loss of historical faith. Like, well, if I can't know her reading her papers, even though I knew her better than anybody I've ever known before, and she's become a stranger to me because all that survives is this, like, what makes me think I ever get anything right when I write about dead people? So that was at that moment that my editor said, do you want to write a profile? And I was like, I don't know. But then I also thought maybe I should. But then I had the idea, because I wanted to throw away dead Ted Williams's papier-mâché head. And I was like, who decided to freeze the dead? Like, that's about the same thing as what I just did. And so I found out about this guy, Edinger, who's the guy who invented freezing the dead. If you just listen to the story, you know this. But, like, first did it. And he froze his mother first and then both of his wives and then, you know, hundreds more people. And so I like very selfishly just wanted to go meet him and have him explain to me what it is to not be able to let go of somebody. And so I went and flew out to Detroit and spent like 3 days with him. And the whole time, every time I wasn't talking with him, I ran into the bathroom at this freezatorium where all the dead people are and just cried and cried and cried. And then I like buck myself back up and go out to ask him another question. And everything he said was kind of hilarious to me. It was like totally off, because it was just, you know, it was very young Frankenstein. It was like Mel Brooks couldn't write this guy. Like, he had this like Igor like sidekick who was this guy Andy. Like, everything about it was like, this is just incredibly funny. But I am falling apart, because I also really felt like it was, he kept trying to justify freezing. His second wife had agreed to it, in the sense that I don't know what that really means, but his mother and his first wife had not even wanted to be frozen. And then I tried writing, they came home and I tried writing the piece, and I wanted to kind of have it be funny and light and amusing without making fun of everything about this man. But I also kind of wanted to fess up that I totally identified with him and his inability to let go of people, because I just can't do that. I'm terrible about loss. Like, even, you know, my parents were still alive then, but, you know, my parents died not long after that, and I never really got, like, I'm just terrible at, like, most people are terrible at it. You just find a way to fake that you know what you're doing, or that you ever moved past a real loss. So, and the first draft that I wrote had, like, two problems. One, I did insert myself into it. I think I even confessed to, like, going to the bathroom and crying, without kind of naming anything, or just, but just, and tonally, the piece just couldn't handle both trying to be funny and also just being deeply sad. And then I also turned it in, and I told my editor that I wasn't comfortable publishing it, but I really wanted to write it. It was a job, it was an assignment. I was never going to miss a deadline. I turned it in, but that I was really worried, because, like, the very first thing Edinger told me was that he was planning to kill himself, and that it would be a real problem if he just died, because your tissue would decay before you could be frozen. Then he had this elaborate plan that he detailed to me. He had a protocol all set up. He was going to, because you can't implicate someone else in murdering you, but you also need them to take your body immediately before your cells start to decay. So he was going to make an ice bath. He was going to, you know, kill himself and then have a timer go off that would make a phone call. Like, he had this elaborate whole thing so that there would be no decay. And I said to my editor, like, I want to write this. And here I did write it, but you can't publish it because I think he'll kill himself out of, like, the embarrassment of it all. So then my editor was like, wow, you are really difficult to work with. I think he was like, I don't work with people who are difficult like this. So, I mean, that's how I interpreted everything that he said. We didn't even talk on the phone. We never talk on the phone. So then I called my really, really, really good, dear, beloved, much missed friend, Tony Horowitz, who was an amazing historian, but had been a reporter for years, had won a Pulitzer for, like, one of his early pieces, investigative piece. And we'd gotten to be really good friends. And I was like, we went for a walk. And I was like, Tony, I told him the whole story about going to meet Edinger and how I felt really guilty. Like, this guy is this cockamamie idea. His entire life is based on a crazy, delusional idea he got as a teenager when he was suffering after just really devastating war injuries. And yet I think he's actually causing a lot of pain to a lot of people. But he doesn't deserve to be mocked in The New Yorker. And I was worried that my piece was too mocking, and I asked Tony to read it. And Tony said, like, all right, here's the rule. This guy wanted you to come. He spent 3 days with you. He knows you're a Harvard professor of history, and he does not think you're likely to believe what he believes about the freezing of the dead. And what he really wants in life is to be profiled in The New Yorker. And does it really matter to him that your piece could be funny at his expense? Not a whit. And if it mattered to him, he could have said no. He does not particularly need your attention. He's not assuming that it's going to get him a lot more patients. He calls them patients, which is how he makes his money, off the money that people pay him to freeze them after they've died. So he's like, you know, he's completely fair game. Even if you were being cruel to him, he would be fair game. He wants this attention. All his life, he has wanted this kind of media attention, and never turned from it. And he's like, also the piece is not cruel. Like, it's funny, but it's not really cruel at his expense. Like, and the fact that you identify with him does come across. So that's the reason the essay was ever published, because Tony kind of convinced me. But it was my first like kind of really difficult ethical struggle as a journalist when I thought, and one of the things that I really took away from that was, wow, I should feel this complicated about writing about the dead, because they're not less deserving of, you know, real care and concern and solicitude for what's fair to them, what's condescending, what's mocking, what's dismissive, what misrepresents their views, what's unfair to them. And I think journalists actually have a much keener sense of ethics around those things than historians do. Historians are completely unaccountable to their subjects. So I actually really learned from that, and I teach that way, thinking about, you know, if this person that you're writing this paper about were still alive today and their family were here in this room, could you look them in the face and say, I did my very best to get this exactly right?
The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the unconventional awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry, and me, I'll be there too. Enter now at tmobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.